Hey, good evening, everybody. Let's start with our motivation. So let's begin with a positive can-do attitude. So that we really have the confidence that we can develop bodhicitta and that we can realize emptiness. And then with that confidence that we have that capacity, then let's create the causes to do that. And so in addition to purifying our mind and creating merit, we want to listen to teachings, critically analyze those teachings, and then put them into practice and integrate them with our mind stream. And let's do this all so that we can transcend the realm of dukkha, of unsatisfactory conditions, and actualize our full potential, becoming a fully awakened Buddha. Okay, so the self-confidence that we can practice the path and actualize it is very important. We talked about that last week. Do you remember? How if you have the mind that is involved in feeling sorry for ourselves, or the mind that's involved in discouragement, you know, I can't do it, it's too hard, then in that mind there's no way to cultivate love and compassion. Because we're too busy thinking about ourselves to turn our attention to others. Okay? So not only does the content of the thought, you know, oh, it's too hard, I'm too weak, you know, stop us, but just the fact that what we're thinking about, you know, is completely opposite to what we need to think about if we're going to create the causes for bodhicitta. Okay? So when our mind gets stuck in this thing of, oh, it's too hard, I can't do it, what's going to happen? You know, we have to realize that, recognize that mind state right away and do something about it. Mm-hmm. And realize that it's just rubbish, you know. A lot of it may be childhood conditioning. You know, you got to compete with others, and we're not as, we compete, but we don't turn out as well. You know, it may be that just old childhood conditioning, who knows what it is, okay? But in any case, that way of thinking completely sabotages our spiritual wishes. Yeah? So don't think you're being humble by going, oh, you know, that's not humility, that's self-deprecation. They're quite different, you know. When you're really humble, you also have self-confidence. Okay. When you're involved in self-deprecation, there's no self-confidence. There's just self, isn't there? Me, 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 me. It really gets to be a drag after a while, doesn't it? How come we don't get bored with our low self-esteem? We get bored with other people's low self-esteem, don't we? You know, if we have a friend who's just always telling us, oh, I can't do this, this is too hard, I'm unqualified. You know, if we have a friend who always talks like that, it's like... it's so boring. We don't want to hang around that person very long, do we? Then why do we sit and listen to our own rubbish? Why do we have so much infinite patience with our own rubbish? Yeah, that's the wrong kind of patience to have. Yeah? I wonder, you know, I'm just playing here. Like, instead of just letting these thoughts go through our mind, I'm incapable, I'm, you know, I'm poor quality, what would happen if when we thought them, we had to say them out loud? You know? So every time this kind of thought came in, then you just opened your mouth and said, just out in the room, oh, you know, I can't do this right. This is too difficult. It's too hard. I'm really unqualified. And you had to say it out loud. What would happen then? Even if there were nobody in the room. Yeah, if you had to actually listen with your ear to what your mind was saying. After a while, it would really get boring, wouldn't it? Yeah? Maybe we should try that for a day.
Everybody else would get bored.
Yeah.
From that day in retreat.
Yeah. Because it really, you know, be just like after a while, oh, you know, talk about something else, please. Okay. So keep that in mind. Okay, back to our quiz. Yeah, let's see if we can finish the questions, okay? We're on question number 9. How are nirvana with and without remainder explained in the common approach? In which order do they occur and why? Okay, so in the common approach to all the tenet systems, what's nirvana with and without remainder? Yeah?
So with remainder is when one becomes an arhat, when one's still alive in the body of that life.
Mm-hmm.
And so it's called with remainder because you're still embodying the polluted body that you gained because of the karmic ignorance that you had.
Mm-hmm.
And then the nirvana without remainder is that once the passing of that life, then the nirvana which arises in your mind is the one without remainder because the polluted body no longer under the control of ignorance and karma is no longer... You've created, you know, ended creating the causes for that. And so you have all these different ideas on what actually happens to an arhat after that.
Yeah.
There are some in the Theravada tradition that believe that the continuity, since the ignorance and the karma no longer exist, that the continuity of consciousness also ceases. And then there are other ones have a more positive aspect, is that since the ignorance and karma are adventitious and have been eliminated, the continuity of mind still continues on, and that the arhat does continue to exist in a more subtle form. So that's the common, the lower tenets.
Yeah. Okay. So the is that right?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. So the common way, in common, is that first an arhat attains nirvana with remainder, the remainder being the polluted body, okay, and so they're still embodied in the body of their last lifetime caused by afflictions and karma. When they die from that lifetime, then they attain nirvana without remainder because that polluted body has ceased. Okay, and so actually in the Pali Canon, the Buddha wasn't very explicit about what happened after an arhat passed away. Yeah, and so some people think the continuity of consciousness ceases altogether, and a few in the Theravada tradition say no, maybe it continues on. They've had visions of the Buddha and the arhats and so on. Okay. Yeah. Then what is the tenth question? What is nirvana with and without remainder according to the Prasangika? And what order do they occur in? And what's the remainder?
Appearance of true existence. I think that first they have the nirvana without remainder, and because when they're in meditative equipoise on emptiness, they don't have the appearance of true existence.
Mm-hmm.
And then when they come out, they have the appearance of true existence, but they've already reached nirvana, so they call it nirvana with remainder.
Yeah.
The appearance.
Okay, so in the, according to the Prasangika, the remainder is the appearance or the perception of true existence. And so an arhat first attains nirvana without remainder because they're in meditative equipoise. So there's no appearance of true existence at that point. When they wake up from their meditation, then the appearance of true existence occurs again. So that's nirvana with remainder. Okay.
So when an arhat dies then, they would be in meditative equipoise on emptiness for however long.
Yeah.
So then they go into nirvana without remaining.
Endure again. Okay. Yeah. So according to that view, when the arhat dies, yeah, then they have a mental body. Mm-hmm. So they're in that, which and they are in meditative equipoise on emptiness, on nirvana. And so that again is at the end nirvana with remainder. Okay. Yes, until the Buddha wakes them up. Okay. So yes.
What exactly are they seeing when they're seeing the appearance of true existence?
What are they seeing when they see the appearance of true existence? Things are appearing to them to exist in the same way things appear to us to exist, as having their own nature, their own essence from their own side. These arhats don't grasp at that appearance as being true. They know that it's like an illusion, that phenomena are like illusions, and that they appear truly existent, but they aren't. Okay. Now, the thing is, yeah, we are so used to things appearing truly existent and perceiving things truly existent that we don't even recognize it. So when I say that things appear truly existent in the same way that they appear to us truly existent, we have no idea what that means.
Exactly.
Yeah? Okay? So it's more, what we have to do is look at it. It's like, when you look at it, this looks like it's a clock from its own side. Doesn't it? Independent of everything else. Doesn't it? I mean, it has the nature of a clock essence that, you know, is. It's just the way the clock is. It wasn't created. It's the nature of the clock. It doesn't depend on causes and conditions. It's just there. Objective, you know, independent of our mind stream. So that's how things appear to us, and we just think that that's the way they exist. Yeah. But when we start to analyze, you know, can this clock exist as something independent of other factors? It can't, can it? You know, because it depends on its parts, it depends on causes and conditions. It's only called a clock in relationship to people who need some time to be told. It's only called a clock in relationship to all the other things around it. Okay? So the appearance of that as an objective reality that we just happen to stumble across is a mistaken appearance. Okay. But we don't recognize that appearance as mistaken because everything appears that way and we think it's true. Okay? So we have to get used to, you know, reminding ourselves what is appearing to me as mistaken. It's not necessarily erroneous and completely inaccurate, but it's mistaken in that it doesn't exist the way it appears. Okay, so, you know, it's good to do this. One way to start out with it is to do it with some other things that may be a little bit easier, like things being beautiful. Yeah, when we see like an attractive person, we think that they're attractive from their own side. Yeah, but are they? Yeah, if they were, everybody would see them as attractive. Okay, so, you know, to be able to say when we see an attractive person, oh, that's a false appearance. We don't want to think that way.
No.
We want to think that they're really attractive. But, you know, we have to say, but if they were really attractive, everybody would see them that way. But not everybody does. Yeah.
Everybody sees karunas.
Oh, everybody sees karunas. That's cute. Right. Yeah. Not everybody sees Karuna as cute. Yeah. Okay. So to be able to see that, and, you know, to challenge it, or when we're tasting food and we say, oh, this is really good, to, you know, as if the good taste came from the side of the food, to say, no, it doesn't, you know, because not everybody likes it. Mm-hmm. Or if we say, you know, the food tastes bad, then say, well, no, that's not true either. For some beings, they think it's great. Yeah? Okay. So beginning to train our mind to see that things don't have an essence one way or the other, but only in relationship to other things. Okay. Or another way to help familiarize our mind with things is like when we are judging people because they have bad manners. Because what is good manners and bad manners differs widely from one culture to the next. Yeah, and you know, I should tell you, the people who are going to Taiwan, in Taiwan, people belch, and they belch out loud, and it's considered perfectly fine. Yeah, and you know, even in teachings, you know, a lama will be teaching, and they're belching, and nobody blinks. Okay? Yeah? So it's completely different than our culture. Completely different. So you have to see, oh, you know, what we consider rude and polite is just depending on a culture, what a bunch of people agreed upon, that from the side of that particular action, it's not rude and it's not polite. It's just what it is. Okay? And so to train our mind in that way.
We're the reverse, because we don't think anything about sneezing and coughing,
mm-hmm.
making a lot of noise doing it. But in their culture, they don't.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
They don't do that. They don't do it loudly.
Yeah, they don't sneeze and cough aloud. In Tibetan culture, you know, at least the monastics, you cover your head when you're blowing your nose. Yeah. In our culture, that would be extremely rude. Yeah, could you imagine talking to your boss and then you go like this? You know? But in their culture, if you don't do that, that's rude. Okay? So, you know, all these kinds of things to train our mind in, you know, oh, this is just, we call it this or that, only based on how a group of people decide to view it. That's all. Yeah, that's all. Nothing from its own side. Okay, then our last question. Explain the 10 points which Asanga explained, by which Asanga explained the three characteristics. And then how does meditating on those 10 points affect your mind? Okay. So the 10 points are divided into three major groups. What are they?
Impermanence.
Dukkha.
Selflessness.
Okay. Then, with impermanence, how many subcategories are there?
Five.
Okay. And what are they? What do they do? Okay. So the impermanence of change. And that's? Gross impermanence.
And then perishability.
Okay, the change of perishability, or the impermanence of perishability. What's that?
Subtle
impermanence. What is subtle impermanence? And what's gross impermanence?
Gross impermanence is what we can see.
Okay, gross impermanence is what we can see.
And subtle impermanence is the momentum of changes that are not so perceptible.
Okay, and subtle impermanence are the moment-to-moment arising and ceasing.
Simultaneously.
That is not perceptible to our ordinary senses. Okay, it's only perceptible by yogic experience, you know, a mental direct perceiver. Okay, and what's the third kind of impermanence?
Separation.
Separation, what's that?
Sooner or later, we separate from our health, our good fortune, our relationships, everything that we want, everything that we like, sooner or later we're going to separate from.
Yeah, so it's the fact that we can't hold on to anything. Our health, our social status, our friends, our, you know, reputation, our job, anything, our family, our body, anything, you know, we're going to separate from. Okay? And then the other kind, the fifth kind? Yeah, the impermanence of the dharmata, and what's that?
At any given moment, one small condition, one small cause can totally turn your world upside down.
Is that what it is?
I mean, things are going along. There's no gross impermanence. There's no perishability. And then suddenly some small, slight change in circumstances.
Okay. Okay, I have here, we consider that while we may not be experiencing the impermanence of change or the impermanence of separation in this minute, so we're not experiencing the gross impermanence right now, we will in the future. Okay, there is no way to continue whatever good circumstances we presently have, for the nature of cyclic existence is to change. Okay, so dharmata usually means like all phenomena, the sphere of phenomena. Okay, so the nature of all the conditioned things is to change. So we may not be experiencing gross impermanence right now, but we will. Okay, and then the last kind of impermanence? The impermanence of the present, and what's that?
Things are going out of existence in this very moment, but the moment you even think that, it's already over.
Okay.
So it doesn't last until the next moment.
Yeah, so nothing lasts until the next moment, that in this very moment, the present, which is the only time we actually live, it's ceasing, you know, in a non-stop ceasing. Yeah. You know, we kind of think like, okay, ceasing, let's stop it for a while so I can get a handle on all this change. Yeah, let's just stop it. I want to get a handle. Then we can go back to everything changing, you know. But no, it's not like that. It's ceasing, the present moment. You know, you can't hang on to the present moment for anything. Yeah? Yet we want to, don't we? We want to put the present moment, if it's a good present moment, you know, in a glass case, you know, with gold around it and hold it still. But impossible to do that. Okay, so how does it affect your mind to think about that?
Scary.
Why?
Because the illusion of control, of course, is shattered instantly. If you, mm-hmm. if you bring it to mind, the illusion of control is gone. And somehow that hanging on or having feeling like you have some sense of control means you have some kind of authority over, you know, over your life. Mm-hmm. You realize that there's absolutely none.
Yeah. Okay, so, you know, when we reify things, you know, and make them permanent, it feels like then we have some control over them. You know, I can line my duckies up because I can hold a ducky, you know. But when the ducky's changing in every single moment, you know, we can't hold it, let alone line it up with everything else. And so it gives this feeling of fear to us, because it's like, wait, I thought I had some control over what's going on. And its nature is to change, and there's no way I can stop that. I don't have the ability to stop the impermanence of things, the subtle impermanence of things. I don't have that ability. And that's kind of a shock for, you know, the mind that grasps at this real I who is in authority and in control. Yeah, because we begin to see that that I that we think is there is fictitious. You know, it doesn't have the control that we think it does. Okay. How else does it make you feel to meditate on?
It sometimes brings optimism, because it gets rid of the thing of being able to grasp.
Mm-hmm.
You know that you can't.
Mm-hmm.
But it's very rudimentary, I understand.
Okay. So in some ways, when you realize that you can't grasp at anything, it brings a sense of optimism. Yeah? Why?
Well, it's futile to grasp. I'm not sure why it feels optimistic. Just because there's nothing to hold on to.
Yeah, so there's nothing to hold on to. It's futile to grasp. So we might as well relax. Yeah, I think that's where the optimism comes from. The fear comes from, no, I don't want to recognize that. I want to control it and make it the other way. The optimism, you know, is, well, I just might as well relax, because this is the way it is.
Mm-hmm. The other thing for me is that if I can really get into the impermanence of my emotions and how the day is going, then when I have these really good places, I'm not so manic, because I'm on a high because things are going my way.
Mm-hmm.
Then when I'm in the space of suffering, if I can look at the impermanent nature of that, then I'm not having these yo-yo roller coasters, because I start seeing that everything's going to change. So don't get hooked into your good days, and don't get so discouraged and so depressed about your bad days. So for me, when I can hold on to this, when I'm in the middle of either one of those, I can get myself a little bit more on, it's going to change, so hold on, or don't get too excited. So
yeah.
It's a little bit more balance.
Okay, so it helps you balance your emotions, in the sense that whatever emotion you're feeling, you're not hooked into it. So if you have a happy feeling, it's not like you're, you know, on top of the earth expecting it to last forever. So you're not in this manic state that's going to eventually crash. And when you see that, you know, your bad moods are also impermanent, are also transient, that they can't continue to exist either, then you don't get so depressed and so locked into your depression either. So it kind of makes you more emotionally balanced, because whatever you're feeling, it's there. But when you think of the impermanence of the present, you know that it's not going to be there for very long. You know, it's going to change in the next moment.
I think there's one other thing, is that there's almost a grieving, in terms of you have to let go of how you thought things existed. So it's kind of like you have to like send it on its way in this regard.
Yeah. So it's like the more we gain wisdom of how things exist according to the Dharma viewpoint, the more there's a grieving process. You know, grieving meaning we have to adapt to a change and a letting go of how we thought things were. Yeah. And so that happens on many, many levels. You know, we were talking one time about how, you know, your friends change. Yeah, so there's a certain letting go of friends and grieving of friendships and relationships and, you know, who you are in the world, the status you had through your job, you know, the feeling of confidence or whatever you gained through your job, then, you know, that's changing. And, yeah, so there is a certain kind of grief that comes. But the grief is there when we're holding on. Yeah, what causes the grief, you know, the tension, is when we're holding on. As soon as we release it, then there's not the grief. But whenever we're trying to solidify it, like, these people have got to be my friends forever, or I've got to always have this social, you know, reputation or status, then, you know, that's setting ourselves up for a lot of misery. Yeah. So the whole thing is, if we can relax into impermanence. Yeah. But then you can see part of our mind going, but I don't want to get sick. I'm holding on to my health for, yeah. But, you know, mentally we can hold on to our health all we want to, but that doesn't mean the body's going to cooperate. Yeah. So that holding on, at, you know, with attachment to a permanent view creates a lot of internal mental suffering, doesn't it? Because we're holding on to what it is impossible to hold on to. Yeah? But then it's so funny how our mind goes, it's like, I don't want to give up my health. Everybody else is going to be healthy, but I'm going to be the one who gets sick. No, it's not like that either. You know, everybody's in the same state. We're all in the same state. And that's the nature of it. And what I find very helpful, you know, Shantideva, whenever we start moaning and groaning about the state of our body, his reply is, well, we were the ones who decided to take the body like this, you know, because we didn't practice, you know, in previous lives, you know, our practice wasn't strong enough to realize emptiness, then, you know, we're the ones who wanted this other body, so be careful what you want, because you might get it, and you got it, so, yeah, why are you expecting it not to be like this? Yeah, so I find that very, very helpful to remind myself of if I'm starting to complain about something, like, you know, hey, I wouldn't have this problem if I didn't take the body, and I'm the one responsible for taking it. My ignorance, you know, my ignorant mind is the one who was responsible for taking it, so I've got to bear the consequences of my ignorant mind. And then I do Tonglen, and taking and giving, and take on the suffering of everybody else with, you know, ignorant minds who are taking this kind of body, and then imagine giving them my happiness. Yeah, so I find that a very, very good way to deal with it. To start to relax and let go. Any other feelings come up when you meditate on impermanence deeply? Yeah.
Compassion.
What? Compassion?
Yeah.
Why?
Because, I mean, it's so apparent that we can't grab onto anything, and yet we all are just grabbing as tightly as we possibly can, hanging on for dear life to nothing. So it's really...
Yeah. Okay, so when you meditate on impermanence, it can also bring a feeling of compassion, because you look around and everybody's holding on to what it's impossible to hold on to. You know, so compassion comes.
Mm-hmm. When I meditate on it, I get a little bit of really relief that there is something to do other than that, that you practice and the path is laid out in front of you, and so it kind of spurns me on to go forward.
Okay, so for you, meditating on impermanence shows you that you can gain realizations that you didn't have before, that your mind can change, yeah, that you don't have to keep repeating samsara again and again. Yeah, that you aren't locked into to some permanent thing, that there is the possibility of change and that you can create the causes for it. So it brings an optimistic mind. Yeah.
I was just thinking about the stark lack of security and how that propels one to really, you know, quit wasting time and daydreaming, and what's
Okay. So when we meditate on impermanence, our insecurity becomes quite apparent. And that is a very strong thing that propels us to practice. And it clears away so many distractions we have to practice, doesn't it? It's like, you know, I'm in the middle of this insecure situation. Yeah. And the only way to get out of it is to practice. So all these other things that are pulling at me, yeah, either I transform them into Dharma practice in one way or another, or I just let them go because they aren't, you know, important for what I'm doing. Some people, I read in American Buddhist magazines, some people tell this story of, you know, the man who slipped off the cliff and he's hanging on, you know, to one thin thing before he falls down, and there's a strawberry, and so he grasps it and says, well, you know, I'm going to enjoy this strawberry in this very moment before he falls. You know? That is a wrong way of understanding the story. You know, you find in Buddhist magazines some people teaching the story that that's the meaning of it. That's not the meaning. The meaning is, what use is it getting hung up and enjoying this strawberry if I'm going to fall? I need to put my mind in a good direction. Yeah, and not get distracted by the impermanent taste of a strawberry. So I find it so interesting the way some people completely give the story a meaning that is the opposite of what it has. Yeah. Okay, so those are the five to do with impermanence. How many of the 10 have to do with dukkha?
Three.
Three, and what are those three? Okay, so the dukkha of pain, the dukkha of change, and pervasive condition dukkha. Okay, so what are they?
Pain is just the gross physical discomforts that we experience, including and up to death.
Okay, so the dukkha of pain is the physical discomfort, you know, up including to death. Only physical discomfort?
Mental.
Yeah. Some people have much more mental suffering than physical suffering. Yeah. And then the dukkha of change? It's what we call pleasure. Okay. So why in our deluded state do we call this pleasure?
It's a slightly milder form of pain.
It's a slightly milder form of pain. Yeah. Yeah. And the thing is that, you know, what this pleasurable activity is, if we kept doing it, eventually it becomes very painful. So it's not that it starts out pleasurable and then becomes painful. It starts out with a low degree of pain, which is what we call pleasure. And then the more we do it, the more painful it becomes.
That's so discouraging.
That's discouraging? Why?
I still want some pure pleasure.
Because you still want some pure pleasure. You can have pure pleasure. You're just not going to get it from what you think you're going to get it from. You can still have pure pleasure. Okay, so you want pure pleasure without having to change your ways. Yeah, you want samsara to be different so that those things that give you pleasure never turn to pain. Okay.
See the above 5 meditation.
Right. Yes. Go to jail, do not pass go, do not collect $200. Start over with meditation number 1. You haven't gotten it yet, kiddo. Okay. And then pervasive conditioned dukkha, what's that?
We have the seeds within us for dukkha, pain, and
shame. Yeah, we have the seeds of the possibility for the other two kinds of dukkha. What does that mean? Why do we have the seeds and possibility for the dukkha of pain and the dukkha of change?
Because we're in samsara.
Our mind is completely contaminated by our grasping and transcendence.
Because we've taken the 5 polluted aggregates, okay, or the 5 aggregates subject to clinging, or the 5 clung to aggregates, okay, under the, influence of afflictions and karma. Okay, so those 5 aggregates are actually the pervasive conditioned dukkha. Because as soon as you have them, the rest is a given. Yeah? Okay. So of the 3 feelings, pleasant, painful, and neutral, which one is connected? Which ones are connected? Which of the 3 kinds of dukkha?
The first one is the unpleasant.
Okay, so the dukkha of pain is unpleasant feelings.
Pleasant on the dukkha of change.
Okay, pleasant on the, it corresponds to the dukkha of change.
And then the neutral feelings.
The neutral feelings for the pervasive conditioned dukkha. Why neutral feelings for pervasive conditioned dukkha?
We don't really understand. And we don't really feel it. Because even in a very subtle manner, yeah. Even no, I don't know. I'm not sure. Well, even having that feeling rise too leads to craving.
Neutral feeling.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Yeah, you can crave for a neutral feeling. Yeah. But where do you really crave for a neutral feeling? The form and formless realms. Okay. Yeah. So the dukkha of pain you find primarily in the 3 unfortunate realms. The dukkha of change in the human realm and the demigods and the desire realm gods, although those also have some form of pain too, but very often some pleasure. And then the pervasive condition dukkha, you know, is what you is felt predominantly in the from the 4th form realm, absorption and above. Okay. That doesn't mean that those feelings aren't felt elsewhere. It doesn't mean that the different kinds of suffering or dukkha aren't felt in other situations, but we're just talking where they're kind of predominant. Okay. And then what are the how does it make you feel meditating on that? Depends on your mood. What do you mean?
Because sometimes it makes me, I don't know if I would use the word happy, but it explains a lot of things, and then you can kind of just be more content with what is, because you're realizing it's just, you can buy all these self-help books, but the whole game is loaded.
You know, yeah.
You can't tweak samsara and get it to work. So you can mm-hmm. just kind of set that aside sometimes and say, this is the nature of things, and I can accept this and then go forward.
Yeah. Okay. Yeah. So. Yeah. So when you meditate on these three kinds of suffering, it makes you see that a lot of our efforts are really going in the wrong direction, and we're wasting a lot of time trying to tweak samsara and find some everlasting peace, and being constantly discontent and wondering why we aren't happy and how can we be happy and something's wrong with my life, and having all this malaleja all the time. But when you meditate on these three kinds of dukkha, then you see, well, that's the nature of our existence. And you quit blaming, and you quit complaining, and you just say, this is the way it is. So if this is the way it is, then I've got to do something to go forward to make my life meaningful and to get out of this situation. So all the pain from blaming other people, from complaining about things, from moaning and groaning and feeling sorry for ourselves, it all vanishes. Yeah, it's amazing how meditating on dukkha can bring peace of mind, isn't it? Isn't that astounding? You know, because another person can meditate on that and just get totally depressed. What would make them get depressed by meditating on the three kinds of dukkha?
Huh? They don't see any solution.
They don't see any. Yeah, they don't see any way out, and. Clinging, attachment. Yeah. They're wanting their samsara to be wonderful. And then when they see it's not, they don't see any way out, so then they get depressed.
I think, too, if you don't feel like you have the capacity to become enlightened, also you can get kind of... like you were talking earlier, if you don't have the confidence and you see how this is a dead end.
Right.
Then what?
Yeah. Yeah. But that relates to the thing of you don't see a way out. You don't see any alternatives. Mm-hmm. So you get depressed when you think, oh, this is all there is. There's nothing more than this. Mm-hmm. Yeah. There's nothing more than cycling around in cyclic existence. How depressing. You know, I can't do anything and about the situation, and there's nothing to do, and there's no alternative. So that way of thinking makes you very depressed. But that way of thinking is completely wrong, you know, because we can do something about it, and there is an alternative, and there is a way out.
And even
in that very moment, yeah, by changing how you're thinking.
I see that this is such a critical place in our Dharma practice.
Mm-hmm.
This is so often a place where people either have either the faith or the courage or the whatever to stick through that horrific period where you go, oh my God, it's not what I thought, or they're gone.
Right.
So it's a delicate place.
Yeah, it is a delicate place. Because many people get to that and say, oh, things aren't the way I thought they were. And then it's just like, they shut down in fear and bye-bye Dharma practice. Okay.
Or just bye-bye.
Yeah, yeah, just bye-bye. Or you see that. And then that's where it's so important to see that there is an alternative. And that we do have the Buddha nature, and there is a path to follow, and that we can do it. Yeah? But if we have that habitual mind of life is overwhelming me, then we can't see that. And we just play out our habitual attitude. Yeah? Rather than what you were saying is like, see it and go forward. And
I think the other mood is the doubt. And then it's good for me to label it so that I can say that's that mind that doesn't help and flip into this.
Right, yeah. So if you react to seeing this with doubt, then to really say, no, that's a mistaken mind.
And you will have doubt. It's part of the path.
Yeah.
And you have to just learn to work with it.
Yeah. You know, when we reach the conclusion we're in samsara, that means we're going to have doubt until we get out of samsara. It doesn't mean that there's nothing to do about our doubt. Yeah. So like everything else, we have to face the doubt and go through it and apply the antidote.
Because they say that you want to live, they talk about that in realization of emptiness. Actually, I found that helpful, that once you realize emptiness, then you can actually really see the validity of the path.
Yeah.
And then your doubt would be just a whole level of it. You might even know you have.
Yeah.
It would just vanish, and you'd have so much more conviction, and then your effort would just skyrocket.
Yep. 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 So you can see how when we gain understanding of the path, and we, you know, definitely when we perceive emptiness, but even things before that, if we gain those understandings and hold them in the correct way, then they really give us a lot of energy. If we hold them in the incorrect way, then, you know, it's like everything, yeah? You can relate to everything in a constructive way or a destructive way. It's up to us.
This is probably, meditating on this week, is the first time that I've really seen how the determination of to be free is the correct conclusion after looking through this.
Right.
I have continual disconnect. I could never get past the disturbance and the discouragement on a level enough to turn it into, well, this is why you need to get out.
Right.
You know, there's this disconnect for me. And this week of thinking about these has moved a little bit on. Now you can see where the generation, the energy comes to have that kind of mind.
Right. Okay. So here you see why it's important when you study and the meditations that you know what the correct conclusion to the meditation is. You know, so like you said, you knew the correct conclusion to meditating like this was the determination to be free. Yeah. Whereas before, maybe you would forget about that.
Or just have so much resistance to going through this and looking at it very honestly.
Yeah.
The situation, I'd get like,
yeah. I don't want to look at this. This is too scary. This is too disturbing. Yeah. I have something else to do right now. Thank you very much. Yeah. But when you really see that, okay, you know, I want to generate the determination to be free. When you really want to generate those things, then, okay, this is the way that's going to help me do it. Yeah. So it's like, I want this, and this is the method to help me get there, instead of I'm meditating on this, and it's completely opposite to the way I want my old habit of belief, and so it's too scary. So it's the same thing, but just what you look at it this way, you look at it this way. Mm-hmm. Yeah, and I think that's why it's important, you know, when we study to be aware of what the correct conclusion to the meditation is. Yeah, because otherwise we get the wrong conclusion. And so often, you know, in any of the meditations, we can do them, and then, you know, it our old conditioning or our old emotional patterns just clash with it. And then if we don't know that that's the wrong conclusion, then we really get confused. Yeah. For example, if we meditate on the disadvantages of the self-centered thought, without knowing that the conclusion to that meditation is the self-centered thought is my enemy and I want to overcome it and I can overcome it. If you just meditate on the disadvantages of selfishness, then you feel guilty because you're so selfish and you stew in a hole. Okay? So it's so important to understand what, you know, what the correct conclusion is. Okay. Then there's two more. Yeah, what are they? About selfishness, selflessness. Okay, the aspect of unobservability, and what's that? Yeah, so it's impossible to discern a real self that is separate from the aggregates. Yeah, like a soul. Yeah, a soul or even a self-sufficient, substantially existent self. You know? Self that's separate from the aggregates. Yeah. We can have that feeling very much, can't we? Mm-hmm. You know? There's me who's in charge, who controls the aggregates. Or, you know, my body and mind may die, but I'm going to continue on. Yeah? Yeah. I'm not going to get destroyed. I'm going to continue on. Okay? And then what's the other one?
Lack of an independent self.
Okay, so lack of an independent self. And that is?
The self arises due to the of having the body and mind, so it's not something that arises separate from the aggregates. It's not found in the aggregates, but the self arises due to causal conditions, which is the body and the mind together.
Okay, so one way to
independent self that arises that is under control of the aggregates.
Okay, so no, it's actually that the aggregates aren't under the control of an independent self.
Yeah, they don't need the
I. Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah, the aggregates. Yeah, they don't need an independent I to hold them all together. Sure feels like they do. Yeah, doesn't it? Yeah. But otherwise, kind of everything would just scatter in the winds unless there was an I that held it all together. But the aggregates aren't under the control of any kind of independent I. In fact, the aggregates themselves are not independent. You know, they don't exist independently themselves. Okay. There you would be bringing in a prasangika view, you know, the selflessness of phenomena. Okay, so how does that make you feel? What?
Irrelevant.
You feel irrelevant. Well,
the self feels irrelevant.
The self is irrelevant. The inherently existent self is irrelevant. Yeah, because it doesn't exist. Yeah. An inherently existent self is totally non-existent, so it better be irrelevant.
Seems very related to the impermanence of the present in terms of kind of understanding what other power might mean. Maybe I got the wrong conclusion here, but, uh-huh. But if the present is going, all due to causes and conditions that are out of your control, mm-hmm. And so also really thinking of the lack of independence here. I mean, even the appearance of the aggregates or all the things that bring it together, all of that is moving at the same rate,
mm-hmm.
Going, rising, ceasing in that very same moment under no control of my own. They seem quite related in my mind.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. So you're saying that thinking that there's no independent self seems very related to thinking of the impermanence of the self.
The impermanence of the present helps me see that not just that there's no independent self, but that but what is there is all. I mean, I can easily sort of think I understand no independent self, but then there's all these aggregates that are solid. So it mm-hmm. sort of thinking about it in that way, sort of in juxtaposition to that impermanence of the present moment.
okay. made that seem more.
Okay, so that's how. So when you think sometimes that there's no independent self, then you grasp harder onto the aggregates. The aggregates are really there. You know, and a way for you to loosen the grasping at the aggregates is to remember that they're arising and ceasing in each present moment, that the present moment is continuously changing. Yeah. Okay. And the reverse goes, that if there were an independent self, you know, either a self of persons or a self of phenomena, then things would have to be permanent. Because something that's independent doesn't depend on causes and conditions. Something that doesn't depend on causes and conditions doesn't change. It's permanent. Okay. So that's often used as one way to help us see that the self that we think exists doesn't exist. Because if it existed the way we thought, the way we feel it exists, it would have to be something permanent. Yeah? But, you know, sometimes the self feels permanent, sometimes the self doesn't feel permanent, sometimes the self feels like, well, part of it's permanent and the other part's impermanent. You know, like it's changing moment by moment, but there still is something permanent about it that doesn't change. Yeah, so it's both permanent and impermanent, you know. Oh, yeah, that makes sense. Right, that makes a whole lot of sense. You know, but you see how what we feel and how we describe things, the moment we, you know, critically analyze that, we see it's just nonsense. Can't exist that way.
I've noticed even in my dreams, the last couple of weeks I've been different people, not who I am in this persona. Uh-huh. And I've been very aware of how it's so clear to me that it's still me.
Oh, yeah. Okay. So even in your dreams, you're a different person, but you're still me.
Right.
Yeah. Yeah. Or you do the death meditation. You know, I'm like, okay, I'm going to separate from the body and my relatives and everything and my whole social thing and blah, blah, blah. And there's me going on into the next life. Yeah, pure, pristine me. Well, no. Yeah.
I was thinking about this almost like we were talking about before. Even when you reach the correct conclusion in your meditation, you don't want to believe it.
Yeah. Sometimes we reach the correct conclusion and we don't want to believe it.
Yeah.
Our afflictions put up a big smoke and mirrors thing. No, this is not true.
Right, what does it mean if it's true? What does this mean?
Yeah. And that's where we get scared. If this is true, what does it mean? Well, it means that I have to change. And it's like, well, I don't want to change. You know, I'm in my routine. Everything's comfortable. Well, actually, it isn't. It's really miserable. And if I look at my life, there's so much anxiety and so much fear. But at least that is familiar. If I change from that, then I don't know what I'm going to be. So we cling to the familiar no matter how painful it is. It's incredible, isn't it? You know? And you can see it so often. And, you know, we see it sometimes. You know, people come here and they're like, they're open to the Dharma and their big eyes, and it's like they're really getting it. And then you can see at one point they go, tiptoe back to that old painful situation that I hate, that is so familiar. You know, where other people are going to think I'm normal and I'm going to think I'm normal. Because if I go forward, I don't know what's going to happen. I'm not going to be who I thought I was, and I'm not going to be who everybody else thinks I am, and I want to be who everybody else thinks I am, even though I hate it. And I better do what everybody else, what I think everybody else thinks I should do. Otherwise, I don't know what I'm going to do. Yeah.
And we've all done it.
And, you know, and that's that point where you're just standing on the edge where, you know, you need a good Dharma friend to just nudge you. And some people, even the Dharma friend nudges them, they say, I'm going back. It's too scary, not yet. Yeah. But you kind of have to, you know, nudge a little bit, just try, I'll hold your hand. You're not going to fall off the edge of the earth.
I'm good at that.
Yes. No, actually, I feel like I try and do it and people just get scared and run back. Yeah, you guys are here. That's true. It's all the other ones who aren't here who ran away. Yeah.
Yeah. Well, you made those same speeches to most of us.
Yeah. Okay. So next time we'll continue with the text, you know, on the Mahayana vehicle. Yeah. Quiz is helpful, huh? Yeah. Yeah. I hope people online are finding it helpful too.